Dawnbreak Accord, written by August Archon and read by Corey Cathonia, for the fandom of The Mandalorian and Star Wars The Original Trilogy, featuring the relationship of Din Djarin / Leia Organa, and the additional characters of Bo-Katan Kryze and Han Solo, with the additional tags of New Republic Era, Politics, Mandalorian Culture, Alcohol, Dinner Parties, Workplace Relationship, Getting to Know Each Other, Keldabe Kiss, Post-Series / Season 2, and The New Republic Capital is on Chandrilla. Chapter 1. The Toast. The 83rd story of the Republic Tower and the new Galactic Capital on Chandrilla is a floor of ghosts. Perhaps not in the most literal sense. The sentients who travel its halls are still very much alive, but the embassies stationed there belong to dead planets, to lost worlds, to diplomatic missions scraped together from refugees and survivors and whoever was willing to take up the work. Lassan, Candovant and Vardos, Kamas, Scarif, and Mandalore, Milagro, and, in the northeast corner, where each sunrise spills through the windows with all the vibrant pinks and oranges of a Millerune's rind, Alderaan. Leia had been offered a spot alongside the more powerful systems, as would be seen as fitting for Alderaan's reputation and role in overthrowing the Empire, but she prefers it this way. Back on Coruscant, she still has Cantham House and her father's offices on the top floor of the Senate Rotunda, and she's proud of what they represent. But for all of Alderaan's history, what she represents now is the scattered remnants of a planet made dust. While the representatives who work in the surrounding offices aren't always the easiest to get along with, they share an understanding which none of the penthouse planets ever will. Their ghosts may be of different breeds, but everyone on Floor 83 is haunted by something. The newest, and most controversial, delegation hails from Mandalore. Few representatives were eager to welcome them, citing reasons as varied as the planets they spoke for, everything from the usual financial concerns over drifting populations, to old grudges regarding Mandalore's pre-imperial role in the Separatist crisis. While few have dared voice it overtly, there have been whispers of terrorist tendencies starting to circulate from stars knows where, and even before the arguments and defamation started, there had been a clear wake of unease left behind in any room the armored delegation entered. It had taken Leia eviscerating half a dozen senators in a publicly broadcast hearing to get their application approved. Whatever Mandalore may have been responsible for in the past, they'd fought alongside the Alliance with as much valor and vehemence as the best of them, and made sacrifices just as great. If they want to petition for admittance into the New Republic, then the Republic owes them the voice and the resources to do so on equal ground. 5 weeks ago, the Senate had capitulated. The new Mandalorian embassy has hardly been granted the most space or the best real estate available. It's a small windowless office on the interior of the building. But it's theirs. It sits catacorner to Alderaan's, presumably because the opposition to their presence had decided that if she was willing to speak in their defense, then she should have to deal with them. Not the best considered retaliation, really. It's situated Mandalore with direct access to a significant and demonstrably sympathetic Republic power, but far be it for Leia to point that out. All told, it's probably for the best. Their armor doesn't bother her like it seems to bother so many of the other representatives. And their proximity means that if anyone tries to stir up trouble with the new delegation, she's positioned to intervene. Not that she's needed to so far. Plenty of people have tried to stir up trouble. Everyone from a major Coruscanti senator, down to the consulars of tiny station colonies, and even, on one notable occasion, a rather prejudiced member of the cleaning staff. But the Mandalore delegation seems to either be pacifying things on their own, or just opting to scare the daylight out of anyone foolish enough to try and cross them. It's never escalated to violence. At worst, she's seen a Rhodian reduced to trembling at a silent, armored hand placed on his shoulder. That said, the Mandalorians don't seem to be free of discord. The shouting she's overheard certainly indicates otherwise, only that the issues seem to be internal to the delegation itself. When Leia had last worked with the warriors during the rebellion, they'd been united under one leader. She can only assume it was the Great Purge that splintered them, because the delegation now is made up of representatives from at least four different factions who are, at best, gritting their teeth and tolerating each other. Bo-Katan Kryze appears to be their leader, at least from order of introductions, and the way she conducts herself. That would hold with what little Leia has heard about Mandalore in the intervening years, along with the fact that she's the only of their representatives with an entourage of Mandalorians whose armor matches her colors and crest. An older man shares their office, his own armor painted pale and his skin wrinkled with age. The third doesn't wear armor at all and frequently picks vicious arguments with a pair of them, while the fourth speaks with a different accent and dresses in bare, unpainted armor. The others refer to him as a member of the Watch, and he's the one Leia has seen the most but spoken to the least. He follows the others to meetings like a shadow, and rarely says a word. Din, she thinks his name is, though she's never caught a family or clan name to pair it with. When someone tries to start trouble, he's the one who escorts them out and then places himself in front of the door as a guard, standing there, unmoving, imposing, and utterly unresponsive until they've left. That's where Leia tends to run across him, looming in front of or beside the door to the Mandalorian delegate, warding off unwanted visitors. Seeing as they have neighboring offices, she's been doing her best to be friendly. She offers him a smile if she sees him, and he generally offers a courteous nod back. On the rare occasions he's feeling talkative, he'll sometimes add a ma'am. Funny how someone who wears enough munitions to outfit a platoon strikes her as less of a danger than the tiny old senator from Brent Hall 4. A month and a half pass without major incident, and Leia starts to relax. Placing Mandalore on the 83rd floor seems to have been for the best. The others might have been unnerved, but they have greater concerns than Bo-Katan's relentless pursuit for the resources needed to reclaim her people's planet. Cantivant has even started some hesitant overtures of discussion with the Mandalorian delegation in recent days. Then, the Brent Hall 4 senator, Kanal Hoebe, hosts a dinner. It's a large, elaborate affair at his local residence, with rare imported meats and glasses of Chandrillan Blue 603, and the guest list is a mix of established politicians and a scattering of newer powers. Leia finds herself seated between Espinar's statesman, to her left, and the quiet Mandalorian, to her right. Bo-Katan is seated on his other side, but the other two factions are noticeably absent. Whether that was a deliberate exclusion by Hoeb, a decision by the Mandalorian delegation, or a simple mistake of the guest list, isn't clear. It's cordial enough to begin with. Bo-Katan has all the social poise of a regent when she chooses to employ it. There's a bit of a near incident when Din refuses any offer to be served, keeping his helmet on while the rest of them eat, but he politely reminds their host that he'd said as much when he accepted the invitation, and appreciates their welcoming him regardless. It's a pointed enough response to shut down any further attempts to stir up trouble. Other than that minor blip, conversation flows as easily as the wine. There's extensive debate about the proposal to reduce tariffs in the Outer Rim as part of an ongoing effort to ease burdens on struggling member worlds during recent fuel shortages. The Espinar statesman entertains them with the tale of his son's escapades into the cave system that connects many of the oldest houses, where he'd been attempting to sneak off for a tryst with his sweetheart, only to take a wrong turn and end up in her father's bedroom by mistake. And only one person tries to embarrass Leia by regaling the other guests with an over-dramatized chronicle of how she'd killed Jabba the Hutt. She has no idea how half those details had been dreamt up, but figures she can probably blame Han for the most ridiculous of them. Bo-Katan's posture slowly unwinds through the course of the evening, until she's leant an elbow on the table and started in on battle stories. She weaves tales of the Mandalore that was, of towering architecture and colored glass, sprawling domed cities rising from the sandy rubble like shriekhawks, of valor and brotherhood and explosions rumbling like thunder, of jetpack contrails across the sky. Din's attention is riveted on her as she talks. It lingers even after she's finished, like a spell or a Jedi mind trick, until Hug cuts in. "And what of you, Mandalorian?" he asks, drawing all eyes at the table to the man. Surely anyone with armor like that has no shortage of valorous tales with which to enthrall us. Din's T-visor shifts sharply away from Bo-Katan and back to their host. A pause, the guests falling quiet as they watch in expectant tension. Din fumbles, clearly not having expected to have to entertain tonight. "I was eaten by a crate dragon once." That garners one hell of a response. Half the table has no idea what a crate dragon even is, but it sounds plenty impressive. And that assumption is well backed by the gasps of astonished wonderment that ripple through the group who know of the desert beasts. Leia, having heard stories from Luke, nearly spits out her drink, and Bo-Katan turns to him abruptly. "I'm sorry, you were what?"
"Hatish Orariu Jashishaya," he throws back with a shrug.
When it becomes evident the table is waiting, he translates, sheepishly, "Better a big enemy that you can see." "Better than many little ones you can't," he means. Bo-Katan finishes for him. Old Mandalorian proverb. "Now this I need to hear," Senator Harpalor chirps in brightly, leaning forward and swirling her second glass of wine. Leia has to agree with her. Din glances around the table like he's hoping someone else might jump in and save him from his fate. But he's caught their collective interest. It doesn't help that he comes off as an enigma, whether that was intentional on his part or not. Everyone is all the more eager for a morsel about the faceless Mando. Eventually, he sighs and surrenders to the inevitable. "I'd heard there was a Mandalorian on Tatooine," he admits. "Went to look for him, found out it was a man who'd bought Boba Fett's armor off some Jawas instead. Town had a crate problem, so I agreed to kill it in return for returning the armor to his people." Leia raises an eyebrow at the idea that Jawas had scavenged Fett's armor, but before she can follow that particular train of questions, Haug cuts in. "I'm surprised you didn't just kill him. From what I've heard, you Mando sorts aren't particularly squeamish about death." True as that may be, it's a calculated dig, and Din can't his head the slightest bit. Instead of trying to appeal to the politician's civility, he looks Haug straight in the eye, or as straight in the eye as counts, with his visor, and nods. "Thought about it," he agrees. "Probably would have been easier. But the crate was going to be a problem for the town,
and taking the armor as job payment meant I didn't burn reputation with the locals. The marshal was fine enough to work with, anyway. Didn't try to lie or double-cross me. With a slightly discomfited sound of acknowledgement, Haug sits back in his chair. Of the Mandalorians, Bo-Katan had clearly been prepared for the political arena. Leia is reasonably certain she's played it before. The others in her delegation, though, have seemed to be hit or miss. It's not overly surprising, given that they're a hodgepodge of survivors rather than trained politicians. They're not the only planetary representatives to confront that dilemma. But she'd suspected that Din might number among the ones finding themselves in over their heads. He's quiet, after all. Keeps mostly to himself, and lets others do the talking. She may need to revise that assumption. Oh, he seems uncomfortable enough at the center of the table's attention, but he's clearly able to pick up on the little verbal traps that politicians so adore setting for their opponents. Pick up on, and neatly sidestep at that. He's aware of the game being played here, his response threaded through with warning but not overt threat. And it makes a great deal of sense now how Mandalore has managed to avoid issues escalating. At least one of them knows how to manage bad actors. Senator Allure badgers Din into telling the tale properly, and Din seems to resign himself to the fact that he's not getting out of this without doing so. As it turns out, he's not half bad at it. He weaves a story no less enthralling than Bo-Katan's, but where Bo-Katan had painted a vista of her comrade's valor in Mandalore in its halcyon days, Din is only incidental in his own retelling. His heroes are the ancient knowledge of the Tusken Raiders and cooperation between two groups of people who had only known hostility before. His desert is a living, breathing character that devours with neither cruelty nor mercy, and his dragon is a near-mythic adversary to be as respected as it is feared. Leia's knowledge of Mandalorian culture is minimal, but she gets the sense that recounting battles is something of a shared art. Once Din starts telling the story, his discomfort melts from his shoulders, and he draws his listeners in with practiced skill, tone rising and falling with the drama, until a number of guests are leaning forward in their seats, enthralled. At occasional points, Bo-Katan will stomp her foot beneath the table with a spirited, "Oya!" And while Leia has nowhere near the context to pinpoint it, she has the vague sensation that there's the same echo of poetic structure in the rhythm of his retelling as there had been in Bo-Katan's. Also, Din really has apparently blasted his way out of Krayt Dragon's gut, so there's that. "You don't disappoint," Hoag says brightly when the story is done, signaling for their drinks to be refilled. Din raises a hand to the server, but a full glass is placed in front of him anyways. "Come, friends, let us toast to the strength of the New Republic. May the starboard ever fly. And to new relationships. May they benefit all parties involved." Hoag raises his glass and the guests mirror him, the bubbles in their deep blue wine glittering like stars on the cusp of hyperspace. Around the table, they echo the toast with the joy of politicians after food and a few drinks. "Oya," Bo-Katan adds with a grin toward Din, who reaches to clink his glass against hers with a reciprocal, "Oya." The table, save Din, drinks. Amicable conversation picks back up, but Leia is watching Hoag, who in turn is watching Din with an insidious look in his eye. "You aren't going to sit." "I don't remove my helmet," Din replies coolly, but Hoag is not deterred. "You come to dinner, but refuse my hospitality, then refuse to drink to the Republic," he assails. Eyes across the table flicker their way, politicians drawn invariably to the mere possibility of blood in the water. How can any of us trust a delegation who spurn even the most foundational of local customs? That's bullshit, and any reasonable man would know it. There are plenty of representatives who abstain from alcohol for any number of reasons, not to mention plenty of species who can't dine in a type 1 atmosphere or on specific foods. If a host is unable to accommodate, then it's perfectly polite to sit with company and not partake in the meal itself. But this isn't about politeness. Not really. This is about Hoag trying to establish pecking order, and having been neatly rebuffed every time, he's trying to force the issue before the dinner ends. "I have nothing against your customs, and am grateful for your hospitality," Din assures him, voice gentle despite the low simmer of annoyance buzzing in the forest. Not that she blames him. She's certainly starting to feel touchy about the situation, and it's not even directed at her. Hoag's mouth tightens. "You raised your glass, yet you refuse to drink." "I can't drink without taking off my helmet." "And why won't you remove it?" Hoag presses. "Do you have something to hide?" A flicker of ire leaks into Din's force presence, tensed like the cocked spring of a bowcaster. "I'm not hiding anything." "It's not worth fighting over," Bo-Katan murmurs. "Just drink." The irritation flares into a sharp bolt of betrayal, Din's posture stiffening as Hoag smiles syrup sweet and the forest stills dangerously around them. Leia spares a glance around the rest of the table and finds the other guests watching with varying amounts of discomfort, curiosity, and outright glee. Even the ones who seem troubled seem relieved that they're not the target of the scrutiny more than anything else. Not a single one looks or feels like they plan to intervene. Cowards. Leia didn't hunker in frozen trenches, the air overhead saturated with blaster bolts and the stench of Tabana gas, to put a different set of tyrants into power. Tendrillan tradition allows the sharing of tribute in good faith, she cites, reaching over to pluck the drink from Din's fingers and lift it in front of her. "That's..." Hoag starts, foolishly. Leia just talks over him. "To new relationships and liberation from tyranny," she toasts, throwing the wine back in a swig that forgoes all the trappings of royalty in favor of the rebel she'd been. Dirt-caked, foul-talking, hunkered in ratty tents with whatever swill the base crew had fermented from the local flora. Hoag's expression twists in a front, but she's not as easy a target as the Mandalorian is. The foundations of the New Republic are built on the ground she'd helped clear. Long may the starboard fly free. The dark slash of Din's visor is locked on her, as are the eyes of the rest of the table, but Leia refuses to acknowledge any of them until Hoag loses the stare down and blinks first. When he finally does, she returns the glass to Din and gives him the briefest nod of acknowledgement. Then she turns to the statesman to her left and asks him how his wife's efforts in the garden are going. She had been trying to grow espinar flowers in the courtyard of their new home, but struggling with difference in soil acidity from their homeworld. Has she found a suitable additive yet? The statement fumbles a little, unprepared for the change in topic, but acquiesces. Slowly, person by person, conversation picks back up until the incident has been brushed aside. Din's gaze burns into the side of her head for long minutes, until he, too, turns back to Bo-Katan. In the Force, the sharp vigilance of his attention lingers.